I call the meeting of the Committee of Energy, Finance, and Policy to order, and we have a quorum. Representative Kraft, have you had a chance to go over the minutes?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I'll move their approval.
Sounds good. Representative Kraft moves the minutes from March 25th, 2025. Is there any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it. Members, we have the distinct honor of having Representative Paul Anderson to present House File 2103. Representative Anderson, if you want to move the bill before the committee and introduce yourself and talk about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and also Chair Akam. This House File 2103 could have a huge impact in many areas of our Minnesota economy. It would have a direct impact in agriculture, as farmers could choose green fertilizer as a way to reduce their carbon intensity scores. The bill would be a catalyst in the growth of the green ammonia industry, and the software this bill would help create could generate and track credits that could be traded worldwide as companies, especially right now today in Europe, seek to reduce their carbon scores. This bill could also help our state and the Iron Range as more work is being done in the new area of producing green steel. And Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chair, I would have an amendment to offer at the time, the DE1 amendment.
Sounds good. Representative Anderson moves the DE1 amendment to be to your bill.
Thanks, Mr.
Is there
Chair.
Any discussion? This is to get the bill in the shape that the author would like. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The ayes have it. Representative Anderson, your bill as amendment to be possibly laid over and on this bill.
Mr. Speaker, and just quickly, what the amendment does is it adds a pretty good carrot in the amendment beginning at line 1-2 to give a rebate to Minnesota companies. If we're going to help to fund the development of the software, Minnesota companies who utilize the system could get up to a $500,000 rebate with the amendment that's put forth here today. Members, it's a pleasure to introduce House File 2103, the Minnesota-Made Ammonia Act. As you know, Minnesota farmers and farm communities are sometimes hard-pressed because of soaring prices and the erratic price volatility of ammonia fertilizer, which is used in many crops produced in the state. The reality is that out-of-state ammonia fertilizer costs are both too high and in many times too uncertain. Right down the road from my farm, actually, about 20 miles away, more than 10 years ago, scientists at the University of Minnesota in Morris and the West Central Research and Outreach Center pioneered a method of producing ammonia fertilizer using the wind, using solar and hydro and other renewable sources. Really pretty exciting. Advances in technology and the 45V federal tax credit that U.S. House Speaker Mike Johnson is choosing to preserve now allow this local production of ammonia to bring stability and certainty to prices and relief to Minnesota farmers. A Minnesota-based nonprofit technology organization, MRETS, has the expertise to expand the U of M's proven pilot program well beyond Morris and match every ton of ammonia production with renewable energy facilities located throughout the state and the region, enabling ammonia production to run nearly around the clock. House File 2103 is a prudent and one-time appropriation to MRETS for development of the software system that's needed, and it'll roll out the red carpet to distributed ammonia companies who are building facilities in Minnesota. MRETS technology will provide an auditable record for every ton of ammonia produced with renewable energy. These records, called ammonia certificates, are a new and valuable commodity for Minnesota farmers and farm businesses to sell in a robust domestic market, much like the RINs today are done in the renewable fuels area. For example, sustainable aviation fuel is one of the specific examples of buyers interested in securing certificates for corn and other agricultural feedstocks grown with locally produced ammonia. And while ammonia's primary use may be agriculture, It also has applications in the iron mining industry and in maritime as a shipping fuel and in the new gen sets to produce electricity, possibly for proposed data centers here in Minnesota. And with local and regional electricity as a primary ingredient for locally produced ammonia fertilizer, farmers will gain certainty and control over costs. Mr. Chair and members, I encourage your support of House File 2103.
All right. Thank you, Representative Anderson. And I believe you have brought some testifiers with you. I'm not sure what order you'd like to go, but we do have Rob Davis with MRETS and then Rachel Stuckey with the Minnesota Conservative Energy Forum. If you would like to introduce yourselves and just talk about and give us your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair Swazinski, Madam Chair Akam, members of the committee. My name is Rob Davis, and I serve as Chief Growth Officer for the Midwest Renewable Energy Tracking System, or MRETS. Governed by a board of directors, including utility executives, regulators, and electric and RNG industry experts, we were founded in 2007 as a public benefit entity similar to a chamber of commerce and serving a specific purpose for our state, to verify and to track clean and renewable energy. With direct visibility to the production meters of thousands of generators throughout MISO, whether hydro, RNG, wind, solar, nuclear, we provide the auditable record backing up public claims. MRETS supports Senator Anderson's bill, House File 2301, appropriating funds that we will use to hire software developers, engineers, business analysts, and others to create a registry for ammonia produced locally with electricity. This registry for ammonia certificates produced by local distributed ammonia facilities will act in a similar fashion to MRET's existing registry for renewable energy certificates, or RECs. Now, a recent report in the international journal Nature Food stated, decentralized ammonia production is particularly promising in regions heavily reliant on imports, distant from production facilities or where high-risk profiles make large-scale projects difficult. Areas with high transportation and distribution costs, such as sub-Saharan Africa, or regions like Minnesota in the United States, where long-distance transportation inflates fertilizer costs, are prime candidates for decentralized production. Chair Swazinski, Chair Akam, members, you know ammonia prices are high when Minnesota is being compared to sub-Saharan Africa. Last summer, energy think tank RMI published a report titled Roadmap for Distributed Green Ammonia in Minnesota. To my surprise, the report mentioned MRETS in its policy recommendations section. The report stated, Minnesota is a prime candidate for initiating the inaugural wave of distributed ammonia projects, and Minnesota stands poised to spearhead the advancement of distributed ammonia projects, heralding a paradigm shift in the Midwest and potentially in other regions of the United States. Economic issues are important issues for Minnesota farmers. This bill is an opportunity not just to advance innovation, but to also bring stability and certainty to an area of significant cost and uncertainty by encouraging local production of a necessary agricultural commodity. I urge your support for House File 2301 and thank you for your consideration.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Davis, for your testimony. And with that, we have Rachel Stuckey from the Minnesota Conservative Energy Forum. If you'd like to give us your testimony, introduce yourself.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Swazinski, Chair Akam, and committee members. My name is Rachel Stuckey, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Conservative Energy Forum, or MINCEF. We advocate for a market-based, all-of-the-above approach to energy in Minnesota. I'm pleased to be here to share support for House File 2103 as amended. Minnesota is uniquely positioned to become a national leader in the emerging green ammonia and hydrogen economy, as we already possess the necessary infrastructure, resources, and expertise to move forward decisively. By building upon the current MRETS tracking platform, we can establish a framework that encourages private sector investment while ensuring market transparency. This approach recognizes a fundamental economic principle. Markets function at their best when all participants have access to trustworthy information about their transactions. Adding ammonia and hydrogen tracking will create substantial economic benefits throughout Minnesota by reducing our dependence on imported products and incentivizing new markets. This investment will attract significantly greater private capital, generating returns statewide and lowering input costs for agriculture, mining, and potentially more industries. Representative Anderson's amendment guarantees that Minnesota's businesses and farmers will have a competitive edge in this emerging market. By building crucial bridges between our energy infrastructure, industrial operations, and agricultural sectors, this approach strengthens Minnesota's entire energy ecosystem. We stand at a rare moment where a targeted investment can position our state as a national leader, attracting private investment, creating jobs, and building the foundation for decades of economic growth. We encourage you to support this forward-thinking investment in Minnesota's economic future. Thank you.
All right. Excellent. Representative Jones, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Anderson, for bringing this to the committee. I think this is a really interesting bill. I first want to say, we need ammonia for nitrogen fertilizer. I actually studied agricultural and biological engineering, so just want to put that out there that I recognize the importance of having these types of resources for agricultural community, and really excited about the opportunity to make that greener. And I think this could help with that. One thing I wanted to note. For the end uses, I would caution and maybe want to maybe have further conversations around making sure that we're not using ammonia for the electricity production. We lose 83% of the energy when we go from producing it from clean energy to storing it in ammonia to then producing it to then using it as energy. We have such great losses there, and so I don't think that's necessarily the greatest end use. But that being said, my question is actually more around the rebates, the $500,000 in rebates. Would that go to the end use business? So would that be like a firm? Can you just help me understand that a little bit more,
Mr. Davis?
Absolutely. Chair Swazinski, members, thank you for your question. The rebate would go to the entity that registers with Midwest Renewable Energy Tracking System and indicates they are a Minnesota business. So that would likely be, in many circumstances, the owner of the production facility.
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the production facility being someone who has the electrolyzer and then the clean energy. Okay, that's helpful. I guess that's it. All right, thank you.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So building on that, I'm very interested in this. As you know, I'm a co-author. But this rebate, it seems to be written that there's only one rebate that's going to be issued for $500,000. Delve more? I mean, that's what it says. Must issue a full on-bill rebate to a Minnesota business. So it's one rebate. Is the business identified already? It's just kind of odd wording.
Mr. Davis or Representative Anderson?
Go ahead.
Chair Swazinski, Representative Kraft, the intent and aim of the language is to say that entities that register within the MRETS system will become customers of MRETS, and then as they are issued and retire certificates, that incurs fees that we assess to that organization, and then we assess the rebate. So as they incur fees, then and use the system, then we rebate or credit their right on the bill. So they might transact on a number of energy certificates or ammonia certificates, and then retire those ammonia certificates, and then we would refund that amount right there on the bill.
Representative,
so it wouldn't be one check for $500,000. It would be as it goes.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is. Is the way to think about this, is this for early movers who are using this to reduce their cost of participating? Is that correct? And then if so, I would suggest we need to change the wording on this because it reads right now as one business. And while you're there, just one other question on the, I'll ask for time efficiency. In the reporting, it says that you'd provide a report detailing the number of green ammonia certificates issued in Minnesota. Would that be... Would we see like all the green ammonia certificates issued, whether or not they were used in Minnesota or somewhere else?
Mr. Davis.
Chair Swazinski, Member Kraft, Representative Kraft. Correct. To your second question, we would report on all of the ammonia certificates issued in the state of Minnesota, okay. Whether it was a Minnesota business, an out-of-state business, or anything. Any renewable energy, any ammonia certificates issued in the state of Minnesota would be included in that report.
Representative Kraft?
Mr. Chair, sorry. And my first question was, am I right in thinking about this, that this is a way for early movers that start using this system to have a lower upfront cost of using the system? And then if I'm right, then I would say, this being laid over?
Yes, sir.
And we need to just work on the wording here.
Right, Representative Davis? Representative Kraft. The language and the credit does have the effect of advantaging early movers. That said, it is also intended to ensure that when we assess one fee on the entire region, so our system is accessible throughout the Midwest, so there might be entities that would be, you know, generating ammonia certificates in other states. We recognize that the state of Minnesota is fronting this money, and so we are returning those dollars back to the Minnesota entities as a way of making sure that other states are effectively paying an equitable share for the resource.
Representative Kraft, any follow-up?
Yes.
All right. Any other questions for these testifiers? Do we have any members from the public that would like to testify on House File 2103? Oh, sir, if you'd like to come to the table, introduce yourself to the committee and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Akam, and members. My name is Dale Lutz. I'm a retired chemist. About 2006, when my older grandson was about a year old, I watched Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth, seeing what the buildup of greenhouse gases and carbon dioxide was going to do to our climate and our planet. I realized that my grandson could be alive in the year 2100. And I couldn't bear the thought of him looking back and saying, you saw this coming and you didn't do anything about it. Since that time, I've been working on ways to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide, greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, including working on several Department of Energy contracts that are related to electrolysis and the processes that are involved in producing the green ammonia and other green feedstocks. Ammonia production currently is one of the largest production or producers of carbon dioxide greenhouse gas. At some point, I will inherit the family farm from my 98-year-old mother, and I want to use green ammonia to show my grandsons that I care about the world that we're living in and that we're leaving to them. I ask for your strong support on this, and I'm happy to answer questions now or offline. There's a lot more to the story.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the member from the public? Sir, would you just spell your name for the record just so we could,
yes.
Just for our minutes that will be approved next meeting?
Last name L-U-T-Z, first name Dale, D-A-L-E.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Cool. All right. With that, any other questions or comments? Representative Anderson, to your bill.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up to Representative Kraft, as I read the amendment, there could be a total of $9 million in rebates. It says the total amount of rebates may not exceed the amount of the appropriation. So this could be, a rebate could be utilized by several companies. And one last final comment, Mr. Chair. Representative Jones mentioned who would be doing something like this. You know, the Commerce Bill and the Ag Bill 2 years ago had an incentive for co-ops to apply to make green fertilizer. And there was one application from out in my area, and it was 11 or 12 co-ops that got together and applied for this grant from the state. So it's my opinion that it's going to be on the farm, on the grassroots companies getting together who are currently buying fertilizer from Saudi Arabia, all over the world, and then shipped up the Mississippi River or trucked up to our location. We're at the end of the pipeline supply for a lot of these fertilizer products. So If we could produce this regionally and locally, it would be a stabilizing effect. And I've seen some price points, and the price point would be very competitive, if not more so than commercially produced. And we're saying ammonia, Mr. Chair, and actually we're talking nitrogen for the corn in large measure put on is anhydrous ammonia, which is just nitrogen NH3 without the water in it. So again, Mr. Chair, I would ask members to support 2103. It's an exciting piece of technology, and we could be a leader in this area. So thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
All right. With that, House File 2103, as amended, is laid over. Thank you, Representative Anderson. And then we will, who would like to gavel? Representative Murphy, would you like to take over while I head up to the testifier's table?
Members, our second bill today is House File 2793 from Chair Swazinski. Chair Swazinski, if you'd like to move your bill.
Yes, Representative Chair Murphy, Chair Akam, I'd like to move House File 2793 before the committee to be possibly laid over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill.
Chair Swazinski, I believe you have an A1 author's amendment. Would you like to tell us about it?
Yes, I would like to move the A1 amendment before the committee for consideration to get the bill into the shape that I would like it. The author's amendment, the A1 amendment, simply puts some parameters around what how the transition would potentially work by setting some dates, setting some lines, and some grandfathering language. And I would appreciate your support.
Chair Swazinski moves the A1 author's amendment. All in favor, say aye. All opposed? Motion passes. So with that, we have some testifiers.
Sure. Well, I maybe you could chat a little bit about the bill first.
Sorry about that, folks. Chair, that'd be a good next step.
Awesome. All right, thank you, Chair Murphy. Thank you, Chair Akam. House File 2793 is a bill that is really just, I think, ready for prime time. It's ready for coming to light. It's quite frankly, it's time. You know, when the solar garden movement was put forward, solar in the state of Minnesota was a potential, really a fledgling industry, and it's really seen tremendous growth throughout the state. And, you know, one of the issues that we do find is when it comes to actual fuel costs. And, you know, with the passage of 2040, with the carbon-free bill, the legislature, it's time to step out of the way and allow industry, allow the utilities to simply do the job of reaching the goal. We as legislators love to carry bills. We love to say, you know what, we know best. But at the end of the day, our goal should be allowing the public, allowing industry, allowing utilities to find the best, most efficient, most affordable way to meet the standard that has been set forth for the state of Minnesota. And with that, that's what this bill does. From a date perspective, with the amendment, the Commissioner of Application shall, what it does is simply close down the program as it exists at the end of this fiscal year, July 1st of 2025, and then any community solar gardens operating as of July 28th will continue to be subject to the same administration. There'll be no closing down of community solar gardens that are currently in production. And then what it does also is just simply allow that, you know, as those contracts expire that are currently under, that they would end then as well, so that we don't have maybe a potential re-upping for the next 50 or 60 years for these. Because, you know, as we've heard over and over and over again, the price of solar is being driven down by the market. And it's time for the state of Minnesota to get out of the way and not artificially holding up and keeping up the price of solar when it comes to production for the customers and the businesses and the families across the state. And that's what the bill does. House File 2793 is a very straightforward bill, a bill that's really ready and probably really overdue to be heard before this committee and moved before the body and essentially sent to the governor as well. So I think there might be a few folks that would like to speak on behalf of the bill, but also maybe with some folks with concerns, and we'd love to have them come forward and have a great discussion on House File 2793.
Thank you, Chair Swazinski. We do have a number of testifiers. We'd like to hold testifiers to about 3 minutes or less. and then to make sure that they introduce themselves when they come out. The first up is Deputy Commissioner Pete Wyckoff, Department of Commerce, and then followed by Ralph Kaler.
Would you like the second person that was named to come up to the other side?
Yes, Chair? Please.
Okay.
Yep. Hard to figure out where to go here.
There you go, great.
All right, thanks. All right, Mr. Chair, and committee members, I am happy to be here and thankful for the opportunity to present today on HF 2793. A bill to sunset the community solar garden statute. My name is Pete Wyckoff, and I'm Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Commerce for Energy. I'm here to testify against this repeal. The department feels a move to sunset the new program is premature. Please be clear, this action will eliminate the new low and moderate income community solar garden, or CSG program, that the department has administered for the last year. A program that was specifically updated in the 2023 legislative session to address concerns about the legacy program. We're not talking about the legacy program today. In a nutshell, the program should continue because, one, the low and moderate, or LMI, income CSG program is delivering benefits to the state now as we work to implement our 100% clean by 2040 law. Two, the program provides a mechanism for low and moderate income households to offset their own electric usage while achieving bill savings. Three, if we sunset the CSG program before we let the experiment on distributed solar models that began in 2023 and was ordered by this legislature play out, we will do so without the benefit of any real data on the relative costs and benefits of alternative ways to fill the distributed solar niche. A type of solar will be needed as part of any optimal mix. Four, if we move to sunset the program, we will place at risk the $64 million in federal funds awarded to the state of Minnesota in 2024 via the Solar for All grant program. As we have testified before, to meet Minnesota's 100% by 2040 clean electricity law, we will need a lot more solar of all different scales. In our solar mix, we will need substantial distributed solar, including the 1 to 10 megawatt size that the two distributed solar pieces of legislation the legislature passed in 2023 were meant to address. Community solar is the model adding more distributed solar to the system today. And as the recent legislative required community solar study found, doing so while delivering benefits to Minnesotans. The LMI CSG program launched in January 2024. The program is tailored to provide LMI households with access to solar to offset their own load, much like any household would if they install solar on their homes. And importantly, in the case of community solar, through a mechanism that allows more households, even with those without the financial means to pay for their own systems or without their own roof, to participate. To date, Commerce has approved 81 megawatt of capacity, just under 10 megawatts of which are already generating solar power. Based on the subscription plans for approved projects in 2024 program year, over 62% of approved capacity will serve low and moderate income Minnesotans directly, rising to approximately 75% when affordable housing and other priority subscribers are included. Importantly, the program is delivering affordability benefits. Energy burdens are regressive and very hard to manage if we don't have the capital to make upfront energy efficiency investments, as is often the case for many income-eligible households. By contrast, a community solar subscription is an accessible way to control your household's energy cost, and it's one of the few ways a renter has to address their energy burden. And with the new federal Solar for All funds, we now have additional resources to drive deeper CSG program bill savings for low-income households. While we acknowledge that the study indicated the program will shift costs to non-participating middle and high-income ratepayers, this cost shift is supporting the very households we often aim to support through public policy. Whether this cost is worth the benefit is part of the experiment the state is running right now to assess the relative cost and benefits of different distributed solar deployment models. On one side of the experiment, the community solar program is up and running, in its already somewhat self-limiting with declining capacity caps in the years ahead. The program has already delivered new solar to the grid. On the other side of the experiment, the distributed solar energy standard, which was created in 2023, is just getting off the ground. We are 2 years in. Xcel Energy, for example, has yet to deliver a single megawatt of solar energy through that alternative pathway. We don't yet know what the prices in those proposals for that alternative pathway will look like or how quickly those resources will be brought to bear. So to conclude, I reiterate, we feel it is premature to sunset this program. It is scaling today. It is delivering savings to the target households it was designed to serve, and it will deliver even greater savings with the new federal funds. We urge you to let the experiment you ordered 2 years ago run. Thanks.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. We will plan on taking questions for testifiers after, but to help with the use of time for Deputy Commissioner, if there are any questions for him now, this would be a good time for it. Thank you. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Next up is Ralph Kaler, and please, Brian Vetter, take yourself place as the next up.
Brian Vetter couldn't make it today. He's also a family farmer. He did send me a text with his brief speech that he gave yesterday. I can read that when I'm done, if that's okay, or I don't know what the rules are for that. I'm just a farm boy.
Oh, Mr. Chair, maybe we could submit that as written testimony to be distributed to the committee.
Yes, that'd be fine. We'll get that in that way. So
that sounds great. Next on deck then will be Alan Campbell, if he could take a spot on the presenter's table. So, Mr. Kaler.
Thank you, committee. My name's Ralph Kaler from Eota, Minnesota. I'm a lifelong Minnesota family farmer. We currently have generations 5 and 6 on our farm at St. Charles. Our family's also the founders and principal owner of Novel Energy Solutions. 15 years ago, there were 2 families making their living off of our company. Now there's over 200 families that rely on us for their jobs and income for their families. We're requesting a no vote on House File 2793. The information you will hear lamenting that community solar is expensive, selective, and not in demand is misleading. It's unique because of the savings for subscribers and the contribution to our rural communities through improved land use. I want to restate a few key facts about the CSG program that appeared to have been missed by some at the Senate hearing yesterday. The Department of Commerce study that just shows that the community solar program is a net cost benefit to Minnesota citizens, not an expense. The study should not be ignored if you're considering Xcel's calculation of community solar value. Numerous organizations have and will show the costs that Xcel signs to community solar are inflated, and the economic and social benefits are not accurately included on the value side of the equation. In fact, Xcel's early calculation showed the value of solar to be over 20 cents per kilowatt hour when the rates were initially proposed. I think to be clear, Xcel customer costs are going to continue to rise with or without community solar. We are not the whipping boy for increased Xcel customer costs. They will continue to go up. No one is forced to subscribe to community solar garden, but every Xcel customer has the opportunity to join one. And if they feel they're paying a $7 fee because of community solar, they can subscribe and save 10 bucks. It's a quick way to be 30% ahead on average. If the CSG's raised cost of electricity theory were true, Xcel's kilowatt cost per hour should be higher than all of our rural electric co-op costs. They're non-community solar garden participants. But in fact, Xcel's costs are not higher. It shows that across comparison of prices, community solar gardens don't raise the price. You can't look at these costs in a bubble. The point of community solar gardens cause congestion and distribution problems that Xcel constantly issues should be a warning that maybe the utility is not prepared for the increased transmission and demand that we all know is coming. Community solar should not be a whipping boy for the management problems and distribution that they're facing. In fact, the developer pays for the upgrades to the line and the substations for each project we build. I think it's amazing to me that Xcel can add 500 megawatts of community solar at their former nuclear site with no problems, but every 1 megawatt of community solar we put on the line is subject to cawing transmission and distribution issues. Doesn't make sense to somebody, but I'm just a simple farm boy on that. As Senator Friend said yesterday, 1 megawatt of solar credits is 1 megawatt of credits no matter what type of solar. That is true. What he missed adding that 1 megawatt of utility solar transfers the ownership and control of electricity from private business directly to the utility, where 100% of the subscribers will be forced to pay for it. That eliminates the ability for subscribers to get a discount from going renewable. Whereas 1 megawatt of community solar is privately owned, the subscriber partners receive a guaranteed discount on their electric bill. That's a big difference to the regular people of Minnesota and the Minnesota economy. Again, I'd request you a no vote on House File 2793 in the interest of Minnesota citizens and subscribers, rather than looking out for the utility.
Thank you, Mr. Kaler. If you would send Mr. Vetter's text to the committee, we'll make sure that we pass it around.
I will do that.
Thank you very much.
I'll check in with you afterwards. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Campbell, followed by Kevin Cray. Yes,
Chair Swodzinski, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify. My name is Alan Campbell. I live in a condominium in Minneapolis, and my wife and I are happy to participate in a community solar program. 2 years ago, the legislature amended the community solar garden law to make it more accessible to low and moderate income families, while also capping program costs. That 2023 legislation also required the Department of Commerce to hire a third party to conduct a cost-benefit analysis of the program. The third party's finding was that community solar gardens provide a net benefit to the state through the creation of green jobs, land lease payments, and savings on participants' monthly electric bills. Most notably, an estimated $7 to $10 a month in savings for low-income families participating in the program. Having found that this program provided a net benefit, I question why the legislature is now, only 2 years later, considering sunsetting the program. Certainly, the tragic effects of climate change caused by fossil fuels are not growing any less. Worsening floods and wildfires continue to drive up our insurance costs. Families, especially with those who have low and moderate incomes, continue to need help with their electric bills. For these reasons, I see no need for the legislature to consider terminating the community solar program at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Kevin Cray, followed by Charlie Ryback.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Kevin Cray, and I'm the Vice President of Existing Markets at the Coalition for Community Solar Access, or CCSA. What that means is that I present in front of bodies like this across the country in support of community solar and represent roughly 120 member companies that develop, own, operate, et cetera, the projects. I've been working on the community solar program in Minnesota since its inception. I was the person that turned the program on in December 12th, 2014, and started to watch it take flight. I also sat across the negotiating table from a broad spectrum of stakeholders for the better part of the last decade, negotiating over hundreds of hours on the provisions that ended up in House File 2310 to enable the new program. This was a heavily stakeholded piece of legislation. The policy was well thought through from a very broad selection of different stakeholders, and that brought forward what is now the LMI Community Solar Garden Program. Overall, I certainly agree with Dr. Wyckoff that this bill to simply sunset this provision, which I'll note has not been stakeholded whatsoever is very premature. We're just seeing this program take flight. It continues to be a robust portion of Minnesota's energy future. And importantly, it's the equity component of the energy future. It's not meant to be the only way that we're acquiring solar, but is a productive way that the state has acquired solar thus far. And again, it represents the equity side of this whole component and the transition by giving direct access to those that otherwise can't participate in the energy transition. I'll also note that having this whiplash from the legislature and passing a new program and then working to repeal it just 2 years later creates a grave amount of market uncertainty. Most of our members are focused on developing community scale projects, but they also develop utility scale projects, or at least some of them do. They're watching this very closely, and that uncertainty will find its way into the rates that they bid into future utility IRPs. So any near-term savings that may be realized by simply sunsetting this program will just be paid many times over in increased rates that the financiers are going to bake into their bids going forward. So just really want to highlight that this is much bigger situation than simply the community solar garden program. It could really undermine the state's efforts to reach its 2040 goals. The other thing to note about community solar or DG generally is that it's irrespective of transmission build out. Transmission lines cost billions of dollars. They take years, if not decades, to build. Community solar can be developed within, call it 18 to 24 months, and it's using existing infrastructure on the distribution lines that ratepayers have already built and paid for. You may hear that there is congestion on the distribution system, and that is considered an issue. I consider that a great success. That means that the state of Minnesota is making the best possible use it can of its existing assets, and that will, in by its nature, reduce rates over the long term. I also want to touch a little bit on the national perspective. I do not go to any state that doesn't ask, how's Minnesota doing it? Minnesota is a leader in this space. It has been for a very long time. There were a lot of eyes on House File 2310, where it truly embraced a good 2.0 model that refined the program. It increased its focus on equity, and it allowed for the program to continue to move forward in a sustainable and thoughtful way. Colorado just last year followed in its footsteps, passing its own community solar 2.0 bill, largely modeled after what we've done here in Minnesota. That was Senate Bill 24207, if people care to take a look. And this isn't just a liberal issue either. Alaska passed enabling legislation for community solar just last year, and their starting point was Minnesota's legislation. I don't know that you get much more blood red than Alaska. So just saying that does speak to both sides of the aisle here. And with that, I know there's a long lineup of other testifiers, so certainly heed the floor to them. I urge your no vote on House File 2793 and stand ready for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cray. Next up is Mr. Rybak, and followed by Eric Johnson. Jensen, I'm sorry.
Thank you, chairs, committee members, everybody for having us and for giving us the time today. And thank you for listening to our perspective on this. My name is Charlie Rybak. I work for Cooperative Energy Futures. We're a member-owned cooperative that makes clean energy accessible to all, which is the reason that we got into community solar in the first place. I'm here on behalf of our members. Our members are rural folks. They live in the suburbs. They live in the cities. They live all over Minnesota. And I really want to reemphasize the recent program improvements are working. The current program is working really well. Half of our members are folks with low and moderate incomes. This is a really strong program and one of the only direct ways to help working class people participate in the clean energy economy. It also contains protections for low income folks that are not participating in the program. That's a really important fact to just put out there. This program does save money. And one of the ways in which it saves money, when we have to put projects on the distribution grid that's already constrained, we pay the distribution upgrades. We pay for those. Without this program, there will be further strain pushed onto the transmission system. All of those costs will be borne by ratepayers. Once again, I would just like to reemphasize, this is one of the few tools that we have for helping working class people participate in this stuff. Renters are a huge group of people that we help with this stuff. Also folks in manufactured homes. We've gone into several manufactured home communities. These are people with huge energy burdens. They're able to get bill reductions directly through this program. If this program goes away, those protections for them go away as well, and their bills will go up. Over the last 2 months, we've faced a tremendous amount of uncertainty from a bunch of different things, from the economy to the federal government to a bunch of stuff on down. And it's very frustrating to be a part of a growth industry in Minnesota and to have our state government even considering creating even more uncertainty for us in our work. If you've ever built something, you know that building things is very hard. It's not a switch that you can just flip on one day. You have to build financing relationships. We've had to build custom software products. We had to revamp those custom software products for the new provisions in the program. To then continue to change the program rules is going to be really challenging for an industry that, again, is growing. It's growing here in Minnesota, and we shouldn't stand in the way of that. There's a really fragile ecosystem that sits underneath the developers and the members and the subscribers here. We have contracting relationships with 30 different contractors across the state of Minnesota. If this bill goes through, some of their jobs will go away, and people's electricity bills will go up as a result of this legislation. So we would encourage you to vote no. And thank you so much for the time.
Thank you, Mr. Rybick. Next up is Kristen Fornes, followed by David Watts on deck. Eric Jensen, I got you wrong twice. Eric Jensen, followed by Kristen Fornes on deck. Thanks.
Thank you. Chair, committee, appreciate your time. My name is Eric Jensen. I'm a partnership director with Apadana Energy. We're a Minnesota company providing engineering solutions to developers, residents, businesses, and other clients. We maximize savings benefits and enhance competitiveness. To be clear, community solar can't exist without enabling legislation. I've heard concerns about cost of this program, but unfortunately, these same comments have repeatedly ignored the benefits. The program, as reviewed, is providing net benefits. The program is not the program of 12 years ago. Those projects are halfway through their life almost, and they will be repurposed, recycled, or returned to farmland or other uses. The second version, as mentioned previously, proved that the value of solar is greater than we expected, greater than retail rate, and we adjusted it downward so that it was less than retail rate during those years. This third program, this third version of the improvements, has been working in a way that provides credits at or below retail rate. It's at retail rate for only low-income subscribers. Most of these concerns around the bill that I've heard just don't exist anymore. This new program has addressed them, and statements are simply wrong. In the short period of time that I have, I would love to throw out meaningful, purposeful next ways that we can evolve this program and keep Minnesota on the forefront. But I can't, so I welcome and will gladly sit down with anyone who would like to discuss that. I also heard yesterday during the hearing that in the Senate that some subscribers were not seeing the benefit they expected. I would happily sit down with those folks and figure out solutions to those problems. Apadana is providing the best engineering, procurement, and construction services in the state, in my humble opinion. This program has allowed us to export our expertise to other states. We are growing our jobs. We are growing jobs within our company. We are building the economy of Minnesota. We are creating a leadership position for our companies, Apadana included. If this bill passes, it will end this opportunity and create reduced competitiveness for our state. Lastly, I want to make it clear and highlight a version of the benefits we're seeing. We have projects as a Minnesota company where we are working with Minnesota developers, one of which is a cooperatively owned by Minnesotan organization, previously who spoke. We are building projects on rooftops, on land. One is with a Minnesota nonprofit, and the savings are going to low and moderate income Minnesotans. Please do not end these projects. Please don't eliminate these jobs. Please vote against this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen. Kristen Fornes, followed by David Watts on deck, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Esteemed members of the Minnesota House Energy, Finance, and Policy Committee, my name is Kristen Fornes. I am the head of NG North America's distributed solar and storage business. I am testifying today against House Bill Filing 2793. NG's distributed solar and storage business is based in Chicago and has been building and operating small-scale solar and storage facilities for customers across the Midwest since 2008, including a significant portfolio of projects in Minnesota. NG currently owns 42 megawatts of operational community solar projects in Minnesota that have been online since 2017, powering the equivalent of 5,800 households with clean, affordable, and locally produced energy. We are also developing additional projects for the LMI Community Solar Program, adopted by the General Assembly just 2 years ago. These projects will reduce electric expenses for Minnesotans who most need the relief. NG has invested millions of dollars and our Minnesota community solar portfolio in good faith and in reliance on established law. According to the original CSG statute from 2013 and the updated 2022 law, the community solar program has a 25-year tenure. NG relied on the program's 25-year tenure to invest heavily in the state of Minnesota. NG signed long-term leases with landowners, procured materials, contracted with Minnesota-based construction partners, contracted with local subscribers, constructed and now maintains a highly productive operating portfolio of solar assets. We employ two full-time local technicians who maintain those projects for us. This bill proposes ending the community solar program in 2028, 17 years earlier than NG's current contracts. NG subscribers, who are primarily municipalities, school districts, houses of worship, and small businesses alike, are in year 8 of a 25-year contract with NG and are already saving money on their utility bills. Across NG's Minnesota portfolio, our subscribers will save more than $500,000 this year. At any given time, NG's community solar projects are all fully subscribed, showing that there is demand for Minnesota ratepayers for affordable local electricity options. Our existing community solar projects provide a steady stream of income for 6 landowners and family farms through annual land lease payments. NG is leasing 282 acres of land to house our operational solar assets, all of which are co-planted with a resilient mix of native grasses. One of NG's Minnesota community solar projects was even featured in the New York Times, highlighting native pollinator gardens planted underneath solar arrays and their positive impacts on ecosystems. In addition to subscriber savings, our community solar assets created jobs for local workers and generate tax revenue for Minnesota local governments and school districts. Make no mistake, the impact of this bill would irrevocably harm NG's investments made in Minnesota to date. NG's customers, municipalities, school districts, houses of worship, small businesses all sign long-term contracts with NG, with the expectation that these projects will deliver the savings and system benefits outlined in existing Minnesota law, regulations, tariffs, and contracts. These Minnesota entities will also be harmed should this bill become law. Now multiply all those losses across all Minnesota community solar investors, owners, developers, operators, customers, and landowners. Passing this bill would result in an unprecedented interference in existing contracts for operating energy infrastructure. If retroactive changes in law were routine, can you imagine the impact this would have on business? Not only would it send a signal that Minnesota is a risky place to invest, but it would also lead to years of litigation, abandoned projects, and stranded costs for ratepayers. Passing investment-destroying retroactive changes in law is not a reputation the state of Minnesota wants to earn. I urge you to please reject this bill. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Warnes. David Watts, followed by Curtis Zahn.
Chair Murphy, Chair Acom, and committee members, good afternoon. My name is David Watts. I am the Vice President of Project Development at U.S. Solar, which is a proud Minnesota-based company. Just 2 years ago, the Minnesota legislature passed a law that provided a long-term path to develop community solar projects. Now, before the program has even begun to crawl, here's a bill that would end it. I am here to state unequivocally that this approach sends a clear signal that we do not have solid ground here in Minnesota on which businesses can invest and grow. Rather, we have quicksand. These projects can take 3 to 6 years to develop and construct, and we weren't even able to get started until May of 2024 when Xcel Energy finally opened its new interconnection portal. So many projects that got to work on day one will not finish the development life cycle before this new expiration would occur. Those developers, many of them small and local businesses, will never have a chance to regain their investment if this bill is passed. To change the law and cause these harms, one would assume that there is a very compelling reason. Opponents of the community solar program will argue that utility scale solar is cheaper, so we should get rid of community solar. Well, why is it that apple pie is more expensive than apples? Because there's more that goes into it, and it's way more delicious. So to figure out something's value, you must look at both the benefits and the costs. That's exactly what the Department of Commerce did in its report on the CSG program. The finding was clear. The program provides $3 billion of net benefit for Minnesota. Yet we are still hearing sound bites that this program is too costly. The real thing that's costly here is the prospect of hastily eliminating a program that creates $3 billion of net benefit for Minnesota. If there's a representative with an alternative third-party report to disagree with the findings of the Department of Commerce, we would love to see it. Until then, complaints about the cost of the program should be given no merit. In conclusion, local businesses like U.S. Solar paid attention to the long-term nature of the LMI Access CSG bill, and we made hiring and staffing and investment decisions with that in mind. This bill would create real financial losses because many of those investments would not get through the project development lifecycle before this proposed expiration. On top of that, this bill would erode trust with the business community by replacing their solid ground with quicksand. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Watts. Mr. Zahn.
Good afternoon, chairs and committee members. My name is Curtis Zahn, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association, and it's over 170 members who range from small businesses who install rooftop solar to larger developers and manufacturers and everyone in between who support them and Minnesota's transition to a clean energy economy. Prior to joining MNCI, I worked at Commerce starting in May 2014 as the Assistant General Counsel for the Energy Division and eventually the Assistant Commissioner of Energy. So I've worked with Minnesota's CSG program since practically the beginning. Over eight legislative sessions, the solar industry worked to revamp the CSG program to ensure the goals of the program were being met and address whatever concerns were raised about it. The industry responded to and recommended changes to meet the demands of many stakeholders, from utilities to equity groups, other energy groups like Fresh Energy, labor organizations, ratepayer advocates. We responded to all of them while attempting to retain the vibrant industry that developed when Minnesota was a national leader and that is necessary for Minnesota to meet its clean energy goals in a fair, equitable, and democratic way. The industry was told that the program was too uncertain, requiring utilities to guess out how many megawatts of CSGs will be developed each year. So the industry agreed to cap itself. The industry was told they wanted more consumer protection, so the industry developed proposals for added disclosures, increased oversight and reporting, and new options for subscribers to easily enter and exit the program. The industry was told that it wanted more residential subscribers, including low to moderate income subscribers. So again, the industry proposed new requirements requiring CSGs to have a certain percentage of these subscribers. And even though the value of solar is the only PUC-approved rate that accurately values distributed solar energy generation, the industry agreed to no longer use the VOS, but rather a percentage of ratepayers' average retail rates. Labor wanted gardens to implement prevailing wage, so we agreed to that. But the ask kept coming. At every turn, the industry met every complaint, every concern, and every desired adjustment. The 2023 CSG revamp was and should be considered a legislative success. But now we are again asked to end a program that is the result of years of negotiation and compromise, a program that provides a net benefit to all Minnesotans, and especially low to moderate income ratepayers, according to the Commerce study required by the legislature. Understandably, this is an ask that we cannot agree to, not just for itself, but for all Minnesotans, especially the low to moderate income households who typically don't have another way to be part of Minnesota's renewable energy future. For this reason, we urge you to vote no on House File 2793. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zahn. We do have a testifier that would like to join us by Zoom. Sabri Fair, are you available to join us? And could you state your name and organization for our record?
Yes, I am. You all hear me okay?
Yes.
Perfect. Hello, Committee Chair Sudzinski and members of the House Energy Finance and Policy Committee. My name is Sabri Fair, and I am a resident of Mankato, Minnesota, where I'm a renter and a subscriber to a community solar garden. I'm testifying today to voice my opposition to House File 2793, which proposes to sunset the Community Solar Garden Program in Minnesota. I oppose this bill because the Community Solar Garden Program, as currently written, gives me the opportunity as a renter, resident, and constituent to reduce my energy bills, and it helps our state reach its clean energy goals. As a renter, I have very few opportunities to control my energy costs, and asking my landlord to add insulation or even have an energy audit conducted has yielded no results. One prime example of how little power I have as a renter is that when we moved in, our landlord said that the pipes in the bathroom sink freeze sometimes when it gets cold, and he would do something about it. 2 years later, he has done nothing concrete about the issue. This winter, we didn't have running water in our bathroom sink for 2 weeks. And when we told him about it multiple times, his only response is, yeah, that happens when it gets cold, and he tried, but there's nothing else he can do. This is unacceptable and provides a clear understanding of where my comfort and ability to advocate for changes that would increase my comfort or reduce my energy costs falls on my landlord's priority list, right at the bottom. But because the Xcel electricity bill is in my name, I have been able to subscribe to a community solar garden, which has reduced our electricity costs by $199 over the last year for me and my roommate. And it's projected that over 25 years, we will save $3,000 on electricity through our subscription. And in 25 years, unless I or another renter does something themselves, I bet those pipes are still going to be freezing in the winter. In addition to being able to reduce my electricity bills, the community solar garden is also a clearly proven method to help our state reach its clean energy goals. 60% of the solar built in Minnesota is community solar gardens. So when we have a goal of 100% clean electricity by 2040, why are we threatening to take away a system that has been proven as an effective method to get public and private investment into energy development? The Community Solar Garden Program is providing the benefits it was designed to, and is helping the entire state of Minnesota reduce energy costs and reach its clean energy goals. I urge members of this committee to vote against this Bill 2793 and keep the Community Solar Garden Program of Minnesota intact. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fair. Is there anyone from the public that wishes to testify? Please take your seat. In the order that you sit, please say your name and your organization. Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. I apologize to the committee. I missed the sign-up deadline to sign up to testify, and so I know that Chair Akam was disappointed that I wasn't on the list, and so I decided to join you. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on the Community Solar Garden program. I want to start by just doing a little level setting because, you know, this can be a complicated topic. Xcel Energy delivers energy to our customers that we acquire basically in two ways. One is generation that we own, like our nuclear plants, our coal plants, our gas plants, some of our solar, some of our wind. Compensation, we are paid for that generation through our rates. The other way that we get energy is through purchased power. Purchased power is where we pay someone else who owns the generation, and they deliver the power to us on a long-term contract. Compensation for that is collected from our customers through the fuel clause, not through rates. Community Solar Gardens is just one more way that we purchase power. It is not by any means the only way. Much of the renewable energy that we own, hydro, wind, and solar, is purchased power, not owned power by Xcel Energy. The reason I raise this is because I want to make clear, having purchased power like Community Solar Gardens is part of our business model. It's part of the way we operate. Any suggestion that we are opposed to Community Solar Gardens because it's purchased power and not owned power is simply wrong. It is part of the way that we deliver energy to our customers. And it's an important way for us to do so. In fact, if we had not had the Community Solar Garden program, it is very likely that we would have filled that gap with other purchased power, purchased from other third-party developers instead of from the Community Solar Gardens. So the main difference, as has been discussed in the Legacy program, which is not the program we have anymore in Minnesota, is that in every other situation where we purchase power, the long-term contract is subjected to review by the Public Utilities Commission in terms of timing, in terms of price, in terms of how we adopt that, to make sure that those contracts are in the best interests of our customers. In the case of Community Solar Gardens, that review is not part of the process. In the original program, Xcel Energy was required to buy all of the community solar production that applied for interconnection with our system. and we were required to pay the price that was indicated in statute. That's a significant difference from most of the purchase power that we have on our system. And the combination of the uncapped program and the price in the original program caused a lot of energy to come on our system very quickly at a very high price and was actually having an impact on the bills that we were sending to our customers. In 2023, as has been mentioned, the legislature passed significant reform of this program, and it accomplished some really important things that have been talked about. Perhaps most importantly, the original program was inequitable. 80% of the benefits went to commercial customers, and only 16% of the benefits went to residential customers. Low-income customers were often even excluded from the program by some developers, certainly not all, because if they didn't have enough of a good enough credit rating, they weren't allowed to participate in the community solar garden. The 2023 reform required developers to bring in low- and middle-income customers, as well as low-income housing subscribers and public interest subscribers, and it forbid the use of credit checks to exclude people from the program. That was a really significant and important reform that was passed in 2023 in Representative Akam and Chair Akam's bill. Also on the positive side, the program was capped. Currently, it's capped at 100 megawatts per year, as opposed to the original program, which was uncapped. That cap goes down to 80 megawatts in 2027, and it goes down to 60 megawatts in 2031. That will not only prevent the program from growing so fast that it has, you know, the significant impact on our customers' bills, but it also helps us in the planning. The problem that remains is that solar gardens price that is passed through to our customers in the fuel clause is nearly double the price of other solar energy that we could acquire on the market. And so the price that is passed through the fuel clause for this type of solar is quite a bit higher than the price that would be passed through to our customers if we were to buy more conventional solar products. And that is and continues to be the problem that we identify with the program. Now, the reforms of 2023 improved the program significantly. Solar garden is still expensive. As XL Energy pursues its goal of carbon-free energy, we're also concerned that it be provided at the lowest cost to our customers. The balance between cost and the other policy considerations in the Community Solar Garden program is an important conversation, and we look forward to continuing to engage in that conversation going forward. With that, I'd be happy to answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. We have our last testifier. Please state your name and organization for the record.
Hi. Thank you, Chair and committee members. I'm Keiko Miller, and I'm the Community Solar Program Director for Minneapolis Climate Action. We are a nonprofit organization that advances resilient and equitable climate solutions. And among other things, we administer and manage community solar gardens. I will be very brief, as you've had a long list of testifiers, but I just want to add my voice to the strong and diverse coalition that's opposing this bill. I'm not going to restate all the economic and social and environmental reasons. I just want to add my voice to this coalition. As a nonprofit that truly works at the grassroots level with subscribers, I will just reiterate that Community Solar delivers bottom line in the pocket savings to Community Solar subscribers, the vast majority of which our LMI residential subscribers. Community Solar provides a rare opportunity for low-income residents and renters, those traditionally overburdened by historical environmental injustice, to participate in and directly benefit from clean energy while reducing the energy burden of all subscribers. It is completely disingenuous and misleading for any supporter of this proposal to sunset community solar to reference the legacy program. As has been mentioned, the industry has met every concern and ask from that earlier iteration. And the current program that is proposed to be sunsetted has already addressed those concerns. So again, I just strongly urge the committee to oppose this proposal in House File 2793 to sunset the LMI Community Solar Program. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. Are there any other members from the public that would wish to testify? Seeing now, it's time for none. It's time for member discussion. And so Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Swazinski, for the opportunity to talk about this. I actually have a question for Mr. Zahn. I'll let you get seated. you had mentioned that previously where there was this value of solar, and that's what the legacy program had used for all, for setting of rates. Can you say more what that was, and then what are we currently using?
Mr. Zahn.
Thank you. The value of solar was a rate that was part of the original legislation, but it wasn't used at first. You used the applicable retail rate until they had the value of solar, and then once the commission had determined it was appropriate to start using the value of solar, then they started using it for gardens after January 1, 2017. So the first 2 years, as referenced previously, were with the AAR costs. And that's where a lot of the costs that you hear about with the CSG program really still lie, because the ARR was what Xcel charges people. And as their rates went up, the costs of the program went up. And I think that's where you see a lot of the increase, very much tied to the increase of Xcel's rates. The value of solar was a rate that was, or a methodology that was developed by the Department of Commerce, approved by the PUC, that was meant to value distributed energy generation and the characteristics specific to that, and not just, you know, what it costs on the wholesale or retail market. It was really meant to value distributed generation. And so that was used up until the most recent iteration. And I can tell you that we wanted to continue to use the value of solar because that is, you know, the one way the state has approved valuing the actual type of energy that CSGs produce. But there was a lot of pushback from Fresh Energy that wanted to, because they thought it would go too high. They were in our discussions, they were saying that it would, you know, be 20 cents a kilowatt hour if you include the social cost of carbon. So they asked to use retail rates, not applicable rate, which was the full cost, but the average retail rate and a percentage of that, as someone referenced, for kind of different customer classes, providing the greatest benefit to low to moderate income subscribers. So they get the full average retail rate, which is like the energy cost. And other folks get a percentage of their rates. So essentially in all the CSG programs, there are three rates: the original applicable retail rate up to 2017, the value of solar, and now the average retail rate, or a percentage, I should say, a percentage of the retail rate.
Representative Jones, do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Tsan, that is helpful. So you're saying that the current program doesn't actually realize, we are not compensating the generation of like energy use from solar to the actual full value of solar, given that all the benefits that it brings to the state.
Mr. Zahn?
The current program, yeah, doesn't use the value of solar, which is kind of the actual value of it. It is using this, you know, retail rate, and so that varies, and retail rates are not based on necessarily the value of things, and so depending on your customer class, your retail rate is different. But I would agree that the current structure is not meant to value it at the actual value established by the Public Utilities Commission based on the methodology developed by Commerce.
Mm-hmm. Representative Jones?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Tsan, for that. So I think that's, I don't know, honestly pretty telling for me that, like, that the legislation in 2023 really found common ground, found a compromise that we're not fully going all the way with what the true value of solar is. So I just want to point that out. Another question that I have for the bill author. I know something that is important to you is that we understand the full impact to the grid and for all the customers on the grid. And we've heard a couple of times about a cost-benefit analysis provided that was done fairly recently by the Department of Commerce. What were the net results of that?
Chair Swazinski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jones, you know, I think you'd probably be better off bringing the folks from Commerce Department up. It's their report. If you want to ask a question about the report.
Representative Jones.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, I brought it up. I was just curious if you had happened to peruse it. But what I'm seeing here is that there were net benefits of $2.92 billion for the state of Minnesota over the expected lifetime of this program, essentially for the 40 years that we're expecting this to go. And that's $139 million in net benefits to LMI subscribers and $116 million to non-LMI subscribers. And so I think this just shows that we're seeing a net benefit of this program overall. And so I'm just very, very curious, why are we cutting a program that shows full benefits to the state?
Chair Swazinski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's Representative Jones. You know, I think the report does highlight some very interesting things. And one of the things we did hear about was the concern that we are cutting this program short. And any contract that's currently out there will be fulfilled to its fullest extent. This bill, as amended, does not allow those to be then re-upped again, which I think is super important, right? Those benefits, you know, you have to keep in mind one thing most importantly, is that one, community solar does one important thing. It, by and large, displaces not coal, not nuclear, not wind, but other solar. So regardless of who owns it, when we're talking about, we've heard a lot about subscriber savings. Subscriber savings foundationally pass the cost to rate payers. So one person's savings is another person's cost increase. And over 40 years or 20 years, regardless of how long this program potentially lasts, that is what we're foundationally getting at. Is that, yes, this program, as it was changed in 2023 and 24, changed it fairly dramatically. But, you know, what are our goals? You know, this is a brand new world we live in. We live in a world where the carbon-free standard 2040 is law. Does the legislator's job to say we are going to decide who must pay? It was brought up with one of the testifiers that no one is forcing people to subscribe. But we are forcing people to buy. They're at the front of the list. They don't have any of the issues with interconnection. They don't have any issues of going before the PUC and saying, hey, is this the most affordable thing that we can deliver to customers? From a fuel cost, it's almost double than what industrial solar is. We do not stop the program today. It ends at the end of the fiscal year. So projects that are in the queue that can be completed before that, if this bill is passed and put into law, will be able to continue. There was concern raised by some of the testifiers that we are going to lose that investment that we took in going out and finding subscribers and finding folks that already want to subscribe. Folks, if that project is in the queue and ready to go, or if it's already on the ground, it doesn't end it. Those folks will continue to be subscribers for the extent of their current contract. I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. That the community solar program as a whole is over 10 years old. As amended and changed, it's just two. But folks, what are we doing here as a legislature? What is our role? I think it's a bipartisan agreement that we should sunset this. The Senate passed this out of committee. I hate to even bring it up. But they passed it out of committee to go to the floor. We amended it. I think we improved the bill here on the House floor. And when we talk about the benefit is a long-term benefit, absolutely, potentially up to 40 years at this program. So it doesn't end it today. It doesn't end it tomorrow. This bill, this program, will continue to artificially keep the price of solar to customers of Xcel and other investor-owned utilities across the state higher for a very long time, and that's what we're trying to address.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Chair, for that. I think we're something that I feel like we're a little confused about is it's not yet 2040. We don't have 100% clean energy right now. We heard from one of the testifiers that one of the pieces of legislation that moved through in 23 that is really trying to guide Xcel to be getting more distributed solar out there has been delayed. We haven't gotten as much built with that policy versus this policy. So I want to just note that. And then the piece around we're exchanging, you know, community solar subscribers we're exchanging one subscriber from that versus they were going to be using solar anyway. We heard from the testifier, Mr. Fair, who said he has no control as a renter. He has no control over where his energy comes from, and this allows him to have that control. So that aside, I would like to ask a different line of questioning. Is it valuable to have private investment into our electric grid?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jones, you know, I think that already exists. We already have private investment into the grid.
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Chair. That's always fun to say. Yes, we have, you know, monopoly utilities. They are private, and our rates go to pay for that. So you could say it's private investment, but really it's public investment from all the ratepayers that are paying it. Something that was really interesting hearing from the testifiers is that we are getting free upgrades to our grid, to our distribution system every time, or not every time, but whenever there is a need for upgrades, when they're putting in a solar garden, they need to be putting it onto the grid. They do that upgrade. The ratepayers are not paying for that. So I think that's a really notable benefit that is not being captured in some of the arguments that you're providing.
Thank you, Representative Jones. Chair Swinsky.
Yes, and Mr. Chair, this does not ban people from investing into renewable energy projects. It's just ending the mandate that we have to buy it as utilities, right? So I mean, when we talk about these programs, right, this doesn't ban, say, you know what, if you want to put rooftop solar or if you want to invest in a community solar program with folks that are your neighbors, you can still do it. If you want to have that investment out there, this doesn't stop you from doing that. When we end the community solar program, it just talks about how much it should cost and whether or not we are forced to purchase it as ratepayers. That's the only thing it says. I mean, we're not saying you can't do it. We're just saying that you can join. I mean, I encourage folks to come up with plans to get in the market and present the price that they can deliver product to the market and let that compete. I'm just saying that the state should probably step back when we are living in the global agreement. We haven't had a bill to repeal 2040. I have not heard that bill before the committee. We're just simply allowing the most affordable, the most consistent, the most reliable, and the most foundational generation to potentially have some competition as well. And I think that is a fundamental difference, is what should our role be as a legislature? We've heard a lot of bills saying, you know what, this is what we think as a legislature would be the best technology that we should deploy to reach goals that we're going to have to reach. Some of the technologies exist, some of them don't, but what role does the legislature, what role does taxpayers, what role do other ratepayers have in that process? And I think we should really sit down and have a real conversation of, does the legislature know best or do the professionals know best on which technology should be deployed, where, when, how, and at what cost? And if the legislature is getting involved by setting cost, by setting price, by picking winners and losers, I kind of, after the 2040, don't think that's our role. And that's part of why we're hearing a bill like this today, And I think it's a good conversation piece. It has bipartisan support in the Senate. And I think that's where we should really start this conversation and really think long and hard of what our role is as legislators when it comes to setting energy policy in the environment of a 2040 bill, which that's that. So.
Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. And this is a question for the author. I appreciate you bringing this. I don't think I agree with it, but nonetheless, I have a technical legal question with regard to your intent on killing the program. So on line 1.12, you want to you can't renew or extend a contract beyond March 1, 2025. So my question goes to those contracts that are referred to as evergreen contracts, ironically in this context, that you know automatic renew or allow an extension beyond this date. Is your intent to interfere with the contract to terminate those? Or would you allow it to continue?
Chair Szwinski.
Yes, Mr. Chair. No, so that contract would essentially, you may have the right at that time, if you have a signed contract that takes you into 4020 as a power purchase agreement at a certain price, then it would not. But let's say your project ended at 2035, and you would be looking to potentially re-up that contract. So essentially you revisit rates, you revisit all those things. If those parameters have not been met, there hasn't been a purchase agreement from you, then it would we would just simply end the possibility that those would get re-upped for another 20 to 25 to 30 years. So that would take us into probably 2060 or 2070.
Representative Carroll.
Thank you. Just to follow up for clarification. So what about those contracts where you're allowed, you have the right in the contract to extend it? You know, beyond a certain term, is it your intent to interfere with it and cut it off, or allow it to continue?
Chair Szwinski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carroll, sorry, it is our goal that the current contracts that are under current signature would be fulfilled in its entirety, whether or not they would be re-upped or not. We feel that is our goal, is to stop that, as long as that we believe that we're within legal bounds, that we are not negating contracts, because there's not really a contract. It just says we have the ability to potentially re-up if we would like.
Representative Carroll?
I don't think he answered the question, but we'll go on. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I find it interesting that we're having this conversation today, and the Community Solar Garden Program is something that I was first introduced to when I was on the City Council back in the early days of the program. Our city decided to subscribe, and to the point of saving our residents significant money in taxes. And so I think that this program is an opportunity for people or organizations who can't or don't want to put panels on their roofs and yet still want to participate in our renewable energy transition. And so I have been a strong supporter. And when I then came to the Capitol and had the good fortune of serving on the then Energy and Climate Committee, got to realize that we can help influence and shape the program. And there were efforts from the beginning about what that might look like and the things that needed to be done. And we've heard some of them today in terms of equity, in terms of capping the program to be able to give predictability to the utilities for planning purposes and so forth. And over the years, we tried to do that. And in 2023, it took a lot of work, and so many people that are in this room were a part of the conversations that came to develop the new low and moderate income program as it exists today. And I was really heartened to read the report that came out of that legislation that was going to go and do an analysis, and to hear that there is benefits to the program. And so, you know, I, along with many today, question the timing, given the benefits that we're seeing at a time when we know full well we need all sorts of solar and renewables. And so to be in any way limiting any of them is not what I would consider the wise direction for us to go. I think overall we're over 800 megawatts of solar through the community solar program, and just think what that would have cost to generate in other forms. So the savings that it has brought to all of us by not doing that is something we can't forget and ignore. I will say, as I the author said, you know, we really need to be listening to the experts. And I think today we heard from a lot of experts in Minnesota and from around the country that came today and have been watching what Minnesota is doing. And so when we look at the number of letters, please be sure to look in your packets at the letters that were brought in and the testifiers that came. And we didn't have, with the exception of XL Energy, we didn't have anyone come in and testify in opposition to this program. And so, you know, I will just say to the author, when you are presenting legislation with the intention of leading and no one's following, you need to be wondering why. Why am I doing this? And is this the right thing to be doing? I would say not. I think the program is definitely showing the benefit that it can bring to our state and that we all need to be receiving the benefits of. So I don't have any questions for the author. I think that it's clear where I stand on this bill. And I just want to say we can all feel rest assured that this will not be making it into any omnibus bill coming out of this committee. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. Thank you to all the testifiers who came today to share your experiences and to show your support for the program. So thank you.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question for Mr. Evans of XL. And as he's making his way up, I want to point out, Chair Swedzinski, you did mention that you hadn't seen a 2040 repeal bill before this committee. I think maybe you're splitting hairs because there was certainly a gut the 2040 bill here. Bill that we heard first, I think. So, look, I want to say on this is a very complex area, right? I've been digging into this and all kinds of stuff, and it's complex. And I want to acknowledge that when the chair that brought this bill and when you, Mr. Evans, speak about the rationale you have for this, it sounds reasonable. And I think there are reasonable aspects of it. But here's what I want to and when we hear from all the testifiers, very strong case there too. Here's what I want to, you made a point, Mr. Evans, of saying that you could buy solar cheaper from somewhere else. I'll continue. So with that same logic, if a homeowner puts solar on their roof and are offsetting their usage, then in essence, you're paying them more than you could buy solar for somewhere else. Am I not correct?
Mr. Evans, please restate your name and your organization for the record.
Rick Evans with XL Energy. Well, I guess I would say sure when someone produces their own energy so they don't have to buy it from us, I'm not entirely sure why that's a cost to our other customers any more than if you were running a diesel generator or a gas generator in your backyard. So I don't know that producing energy for yourself and thereby lowering your bill is a cost to our other customers. Now, through net metering, if you sell energy back onto the grid, that is a cost to our customers. But frankly, for most rooftop systems, that's a relatively small amount.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I appreciate all that, but my question was very specific. If the homeowner wasn't producing energy on their roof, they would be paying XL and for the retail rate, right? You could be acquiring solar then somewhere else for less than you would not pay them, or they would not pay you, right? Like, I'll try this again. If they were not producing solar on their roof, they'd be paying you retail rate, correct?
Correct.
Right. And if they do have solar on their roof, for whatever they're doing, they're not paying you retail rate. So that's, by the logic you said before, you could say, you know what, we shouldn't allow solar on people's roofs because we can buy it cheaper elsewhere. And I haven't asked the question yet. You'll be able to respond. Now, I'm not saying that that's the right logic, right? But that's, in a sense, you take your argument and it's the same argument. What we're saying is, you know what? If someone doesn't own their own house, they should have a way to participate in this in a discount fashion that someone on their roof, that deploying on their roof can. This is complex, right? There's so many, you can argue with me on this. I can argue back on this. We did this 2 years ago ad nauseum and came up with a compromise position with both sides. And I don't see the reason that we need to revisit this now. We have a compromise system that's working. We have a study that says, you know what? The net benefits to rate payers and non-rate payers is better. And so that directly contradicts what Chair Swedzinski said. We are in the midst of transitioning from a centralized approach to power generation to a much more decentralized approach. And there's all kinds of complexities in here that are coming up. And I think we've worked a very good compromise, and there's no reason to change it right now. Thank you.
Mr. Evans, you have a follow-up comment?
I'm not sure that the comparison, I'm following the comparison between rooftop solar and solar gardens, but first of all, let me say, I think the legislation in 2023 made tremendous improvements in the community solar garden program. No question about that, both in terms of the inequities that existed for the previous 10 years and in terms of putting a cap on the program so it was more predictable. But the purpose of my testimony here today is only to point out that this is still a very expensive way to provide energy to most of our customers. Keep in mind, after over 10 years of this program, there's about just a little under 30,000 of our customers participating that are getting the benefits of the program. But we have 1.4 million customers, and that means 1.3 point something of them are not getting any of the benefits from this. The other thing I'll point out, and again, in terms of the net benefits, looking forward, I don't want to argue about the past. We could probably have a debate about that, but looking forward, if you look at our resource plan, if you look at our plans to get to 100% by 2040, we are going to put a certain amount of solar on our system. The environmental benefits, which make up the bulk of the benefits that were noted in the Department of Commerce study, don't exist if you replace this solar with other solar. The solar has the same environmental benefits. So, again, if you'll notice in my testimony, I'm just here to point out the fact this is an expensive program, and as we move forward towards 2040, we should think about the costs. But you're right, it's a very complicated program, and so it's going to take a longer discussion.
Representative Kraft?
I do have a question for the
Representative Akin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Evans, you just made me think about what we also passed in the 23 reforms, and that was a forbid DG program, and to start at the same time. And so how many of those projects do you have completed at this point?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, thanks for the question. The RFP for those projects has gone out. We are receiving proposals right now. Those proposals we may actually have available to the public by the end of the session. I don't know if we will, but that program is just starting up. Keep in mind, that was a new program that started in 2024 and has taken some time to get it up and running. So we will see results from that soon.
Representative Akin.
Thank you. Just a follow-up comment, and that's really the point, that the 2023 Community Solar Garden Program has gardens that have been built and had the ability for the department to do an analysis. It also wanted to look at the Excel program, which wasn't up and running yet, so we couldn't. And so I think the speed with which the development community can get solar gardens put up compared to the utility is an indicator that we need to continue to have private development in our solar industry.
Representative Kraft.
I'm good.
Chair Szwinski, final comments?
You got other folks. Oh, are we there? That's
yeah.
At that point? Okay.
Yeah. No.
All right. Again, thank you. Thank you to all the testifiers that came before the committee today. Thank you, members, for hearing the concerns and the positives of 2793. You know, it was brought up, you know, the quickness in deployment, but also we need to always keep in mind the quickness in need. Minnesota does not have a shortage of electricity. Minnesota does not have a shortage of solar. We actually have an abundance of solar when it comes to the actual need and the deployment and the way that it reacts within the economy and the way it reacts within the grid. There is not a shortage of solar. And it's duplicative in nature. So solar on its own does not exist as the primary power source. It replaces and it must be backed up by base load energy. And I think Representative Igoe has made the point plenty well when it comes to what is it like and what does the future look like to gain and garner the positives of base load energy in our economy when it comes to attracting major business, major investment, major deployment of assets within the state. Folks, we've got a role to play as a legislature when it comes to energy in the state. And my argument as 2793 states is it's time for our role to take a step back and allow 2040 to navigate the uniqueness of deploying diverse energy systems onto the grid. Whether that's nuclear, whether that's clean coal, whether that's large hydro, whether that's wind, whether that's solar. We should take the tact of being nonpartisan, non-technology biased in our approach. I think one of the rural utilities said it best. They said, our goal is that all tech is on deck. With that, thank you.
With that, House File 2793, as amended, is laid over. Thank you, Chair Szwinski. Members, that's all for today. Our next meeting is Tuesday, April 1st, where Chair Akam will have the gavel. This meeting is adjourned.